Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sambi. I'm the host of the Asia-Pacific leg of Sea Control and an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra. Today, we'll be looking at Indonesia. It's the largest country in Southeast Asia and growing in significance as years go by. A country of 16,000 islands and 250 million people. It's recently concluded a presidential election, so we'll be looking at the political future of the country. More specifically, I'll have two guests. My first is Dr. Peter McCauley at the Australian National University, a specialist in Indonesian economics. He and I will be discussing the kinds of priorities Indonesia needs to address in order to be able to strengthen its economy and then look towards perhaps spending more on military capability and the challenges therein. And my second guest will be Dr. Ross Tapsell. He's a specialist in media studies at the Australian National University as well, and he recently spent time in Jakarta and in Java following the campaign trails of both presidential candidates, and he will be sharing some insights about some of the political challenges ahead and why the recent election was so important for international observers like Australia and the United States. So before we start with our two guests, we'll be back after this short break.
Hola nuestros amigos, do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next World blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
And welcome back from that quick break. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about Indonesia. It's just experienced its recent election in which 130 million votes were cast. It was a choice between the can-do Jakarta governor known as Joko Widodo, an everyday man, or the former Kopassus commander Prabowo Subianto, who is connected back to the Suharto regime. In the end, it was Joko Widodo who was triumphant, who won with a slim margin. But there are lots of questions that remain about Indonesia's future, of course, under his leadership. It has plans of being an activist middle power. It also has a military modernization program in which it seeks a minimum essential force. But of course, it comes down to the choice between guns and butter. In order to be able to do these kinds of things, you have to have an economy in a rising state. So today, my guest is Dr. Peter McCauley. He's a visiting fellow at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's published extensively on economic affairs in Asia, particularly on issues concerning the Indonesian economy. Thank you very much for joining me this morning, Peter.
Hi, Natalie.
So just to get started, as I mentioned, you know, Indonesia has a lot of grand plans. And what I'd like to do is introduce our audience into some of the rough contours of where Indonesia's economy is at.
Well, basically, the economy has done moderately well in the past 3 or 4 years. It took a long time to recover from the Asian financial crisis in 97-98, but it has recovered and it is now growing. Looking ahead, however, the challenges are very substantial, very substantial. Indonesia has a long way to go to strengthen its economy, not least because the total population is 250 million people, and there are a lot of needs there. There are a lot of basic needs, and it really is going to be quite a while before Indonesia has sufficient strength, if you like, to project much power around the region. It's effective enough at present, or semi-effective, let's put it that way, in protecting its maritime borders and its maritime area. And that, along with domestic stability, will probably be the priorities for the next 10 years or so.
I see. Just drilling down a little bit into what you said, the major issues that it's got domestically, what are the kinds of areas that Indonesia needs to address as a matter of urgency?
Well, perhaps the single most central issue is mass poverty. More than more than 50% of the Indonesian population are pretty poor. Almost 50% live below or at $2 a day. So the simple struggle to go to school, to get food for your kids, to find a job, these are the things that dominate almost 50%, the lives of almost 50% of the Indonesian population. More broadly, a major challenge is to develop infrastructure. Infrastructure is still badly underdeveloped. The Indonesian government knows it. Everybody talks about it. But this means things, if we're talking about maritime strength, this means things like ports are badly underdeveloped. Roads are underdeveloped, so it is difficult to move strategic assets around the nation. So those are really two main challenges. The first is simply tackling mass poverty, lifting the living standards of the mass of the population. And second, very urgent to develop infrastructure.
Okay, great. Just on that first one, in terms of those urgent issues of poverty there, is there a role for foreign partners?
Yes, I think there's a role, but it needs to be a cautious one. We know from all around the world that it is difficult to tackle poverty because there are social and political issues as well as economic issues. In some ways, the best way to tackle all of those complex issues in the poverty area, I think for foreign organisations, is probably to help with infrastructure. Mm-hmm. For example, supplies of water are very important. Water is important for kids. It's important for women. All over Indonesia, millions of women every day, and kids too, carry water. They get water from wells in buckets and carry them. Now, this is a very inefficient way of collecting water. And the water is often polluted, so there are health problems. So what the international community can do, and it might not seem to be a direct attack on poverty, mm-hmm. but it's very helpful to provide to help develop basic infrastructure.
It's really interesting here, this picture that you're painting, I mean, quite of the fundamental challenges at the grassroots level of people carrying water, women and children. That sometimes stands in stark contrast with the image that's portrayed by the international community of Indonesia as this rising middle power, or certainly as Yudhoyono has portrayed it in the past. I mean, is that correct? What's the gap, rather, between what's going on at the ground level as you see it and that perception of Indonesia as a rising economic and even security power?
Yes, it's a dilemma. And the elite of Indonesia, like the elite of China or the elite of India, are really trying to do two things at once. They're trying to modernize their nation and trying to build up the strength of the nation state and play a role in the region. That's, if you like, the high-level idealistic national building role. But behind them, when they look out of the window or when they travel across their nation, they still see awful development problems. So they're trying to do both. And it's not all that easy. And sometimes at the international level, we see more of the first, the nation building side. We see the president coming to the G20. But what we need to remember is that behind that attempt to build up respectability and play an international role, there is still a long job of nation building that needs to be done. Now, I think they know it. The presidents of China and Indonesia and the Prime Minister of India, they know it. They're very aware of these two challenges. But internationally, we probably need to be more aware of it as well.
I see. Speaking also on that international level there, I just wanted to deviate for a second to relations between Indonesia and China. What I understand is that relationship economically is growing as time goes by, although that there's still some challenges. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship and what it means for Indonesia?
Yes, well, we need to remember that Indonesia is the world's third largest developing country. The order of magnitude is China, India and Indonesia. Now, Indonesia is aware of this. Indonesia is aware of the role that it should play, if you like, as a leading nation in Southeast Asia. It is the de facto leader. People don't necessarily acknowledge this, but it's the de facto leader of ASEAN, and Indonesian leaders are aware of it. And so when they look around the world, they see China, a growing strength in the region. They recall, of course, the continuing strength of Japan. They see America, they see Europe, way over to the west, and they see India not so far away. And they see Indonesia as a leader of ASEAN really juggling these roles. They know that ASEAN as a whole needs to build its strength. ASEAN as a whole needs to hang together, hold together, because fragmented, ASEAN does not have a lot of strength. And so Indonesia's views vis-a-vis China are first to acknowledge that it is, of course, a growing power, but second to watch it with some concern, with some awareness that at the end of the day it will promote its own interests in the region. And Indonesia looks, as do other countries in the region, for really a balance between the powerful nations in the region. They hope very much that peace and stability will prevail, because they know that if peace and stability does not prevail, it leads to huge problems for the region.
Right. Looking for other sort of areas in which there are agreements, you know, stabilizing factors like multilateral agreements and whatnot, I wanted to delve a little bit more into the US side of things, things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Obviously, Indonesia is considering this at this point in time, but it's not developed on those negotiations. Could you discuss a little bit about where Indonesia's at and what the prospects you think are of Indonesia looking towards the United States with these kinds of agreements?
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is in a state of hesitancy, I would say, if you like. The real problem for countries such as Indonesia, and other countries in the region too, of course, the real problem is that it is not clear at the end of the day that the United States Congress will agree to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So there's a real problem here of negotiating, very difficult negotiations and sometimes tense negotiations, and they may come to naught anyway, even if they can get agreement with the negotiating partners. When the TPP, as it's called, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is taken to the US Congress, there is no guarantee at all. It's at best 50-50 that the TPP would be approved. But leaving that problem aside, Indonesia is currently going through a stage of re-examination, reconsideration, I guess, about external agreements. There are various reasons for that, but one major reason is that it's currently suffering to some extent from a bout of indigestion. And the indigestion relates to ASEAN. There are plans, as I think most people know, for an ASEAN economic cooperation agreement. There are progressing plans, it's moving ahead, to integrate the economies of ASEAN. And I think that's very welcome, and I think it's going reasonably well. But Indonesia is having indigestion problems, as are other countries in the region. And in a sense, they are so busy with local problems, the problems of trying to get ASEAN to work, that it is difficult to spend a lot of time, a lot of energy of the administration thinking about broader issues.
I mean, because there seems to be a lot of enthusiasm in the United States for having Indonesia play a role in areas like the South China Sea, where relationships between ASEAN states and China are concerned. So is there a chance that that role might be... Are there too many expectations of Indonesia at this point in time? Is that something that could be realized in future, and under what conditions might that occur?
We mustn't hope for too much from Indonesia in the medium term. As I say, its main challenges are at home, and we need to keep remembering that. There was a famous American politician, Tip O'Neill, who's famous for his statement that all politics are local, and that's true for Indonesia as well. So the new president of Indonesia, and we assume it's President Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi, he will have his hands full with matters at home, and he'll have only a little bit of time available, maybe 5% of his time available for wider regional matters. I guess what I'm saying is it would be a mistake for the international community to try to expect too much of Indonesia or to load too much onto Indonesia, because it simply won't be able to deliver. We, the international community, need to have realistic expectations. It's very important. Realism in international affairs is terribly important. And we would be better off agreeing with our Indonesian colleagues to aim for realistic targets, rather than set targets that are too ambitious and then fail. I'm all in favour of working with Indonesia in the region, and we should do that, but let's have realistic targets.
I see. And is there anything that you could add there? I mean, as you mentioned, so far it looks like Joko Widodo has the presidency, pending a constitutional court challenge by Prabowo Subianto. But are there any sort of real things we could expect from Jokowi in the next 5 years?
No, not immediately. I think there's a big question mark. You're asking a question that really we are all asking at present. Joko Widodo has risen very quickly. He is, in a sense, an untested leader. He spent a little over 12 months as governor of Jakarta, but he wasn't there very long. It's an astonishing rise, really. He's a relatively small-scale businessman from a town in central Java, Surakarta, sometimes known as Solo, and he's now found himself the president of Indonesia. We're subject to confirmation, but we expect it'll be confirmed, and in effect the leading politician in ASEAN, with a total population of 600 million people, ASEAN. So it's an astonishing rise, and I think we're all asking this question. What is he going to do at home? What are his relations going to be across the political scene at home, which will give him strength or weakness, depending on how he plays them? And what role is he going to play in the region? On that latter one, Joko Widodo does not have much of an international track record that we know of. There are a few statements on the record, but they're fairly thin. And the truth is, we don't know. Now, of course, we're hoping for the best. He shows every sign of being a very reasonable person. But within a month or so of him taking office, there are important meetings in the region. President Obama has already said that President Obama, looks forward to seeing President Joko Widodo at an APEC meeting, and there'll be a G20 meeting in Australia. So these will be early challenges and early tests, really. We, those of us who work on Indonesia, will be watching Joko Widodo, because he will come, no doubt, with briefing from the Indonesian Department of Foreign Affairs and the Indonesian Armed Forces and think tanks across Indonesia and so on, and he will be finding his way. So that's certainly a very interesting challenge and a very interesting period. November, late October, November this year will be an important period for those of us who are interested in the foreign policy of Indonesia.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Peter. So just to recap there, there's a lot ahead for Indonesia in the coming months after Joko Widodo's, hopefully, his inauguration in October. There'll be some early tests of what his foreign policy will be as he attends some of the leading international summits around October, November. It also has a lot of domestic challenges, so perhaps the international community could recalibrate its expectations of Indonesia and be mindful of that. So just to say thank you again, Dr. McCauley. My guest was a visiting fellow at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the Australian National University. You can also catch his writing on the Crawford School's blog known as East Asia Forum, or catch some of his interviews online as well.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast? It's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Don't forget to sign up at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and announcements by email. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. This and other fine forums can be found on our homepage. Join the discussion.
And now we're talking with Dr. Ross Tapsell, who's a lecturer at the College of Asia Pacific at the Australian National University in Canberra. Thanks for joining me, Ross.
Hi, Nat.
I've got Ross here today because Ross has spent a fair bit of time looking at Indonesia over the years. He's also spent time in Jakarta during the election campaign for the 2014 presidential election that had come down between two candidates, Joko Widodo, the Jakarta governor, and Prabowo Subianto, the former Kopassus commander. Now, for the benefit of our audience here, what I'd like to do is just draw out a couple of points about what this presidential election meant for Indonesia and why it was so important. So perhaps we'll start off about, you know, why was it such a tight race?
Well, it was a stark difference, and I think that's important to state right from the outset that Indonesians had a choice of a new leader in Joko Widodo, who started out as the mayor of Solo, who went on to be the Jakarta governor, and now is the president. And this is a new and exciting time, and he represented the new reformist democratic in Indonesia. The other candidate, Prabowo Subianto, of course, comes from the New Order elite. He's a former military general, and his campaign was very much about a nationalistic and also, you know, to some extent, rather not necessarily looking at democracy as the system which Indonesia needs. So although he did state, you know, I am a Democrat and I mm-hmm. support democracy, he often talked about the problems of democracy. So it was a stark choice for Indonesia.
It's interesting though, because as you say, I mean, and particularly the commentary in Australia tend to suggest that Prabowo might not have been the best option for Indonesia's future. But the result, you know, when it was confirmed by Electoral Commission, it was 53% in support of Jokowi and 47% for Prabowo Subianto. Now that's not it's a significant figure there. I mean, if he isn't the guy, you know, that countries like Australia, United States might want to partner with, why were Indonesians voting for him?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's something that I think we're still figuring out. I mean, one thing that I saw on the ground with Jokowi's campaign was how disjointed it was, and how he didn't really run a very professional, highly structured, you know, well-planned campaign. It was very much just about getting on the ground to see as many people as possible. And so I think a lot of people turned away from Jokowi because he didn't have a clear message, and he didn't speak out very much against his opponent. And this was one reason why I think people turned towards Prabowo.
I see. Okay. So now it looks as though Jokowi will, 99.9%, she'll take the presidency and he'll be inaugurated in October. There's not a lot known about his policies, but what do we know? What sort of things has he said so far about what he'll do for the country?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the problems, as I said, with his campaign is that he didn't articulate a very strong vision. So a lot of this is very much, we are still speculating on what this will mean. He had a program of the mental revolution, and he talked about, and in fact, one of his lines at the end was politics is fun, which I think is a kind of new approach. And so we are looking at reform here with Jokowi.
Okay.
But certainly... what we will see is a very practical type of leadership. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not someone for grand statements, and in the same way that SBY has had a lot of ceremonies.
Yep.
Jokowi's a very practical leader, so we'll see a very practical approach.
Excellent. So let's just look at Indonesia broadly speaking. So we're talking about the largest country in Southeast Asia. We're talking about the de facto leader of the ASEAN grouping. We're talking about the fourth largest country by population in the world, and the largest democratic Muslim majority state as well. So looking at Indonesia's role and you know, its priorities, what do you think Jokowi should address first? I mean, if you look at Indonesia and its challenges, what should he really focus on?
Well, there'll be a number of things that he'll focus on, and it's hard to pinpoint one that in terms of obviously, the first thing he'll have to do will be to sort out what kind of minister and cabinet he wants. And this will, of course, mean having to negotiate with some of the old elites, and including those that have been in his coalition. One of the things he'll have to sort out internally is how his party, the PDIP, is going to push for him, or whether he indeed starts to look at forming his own party, which there's rumours that's the case because of the internal factions. So, I mean, there's a lot of internal issues that he'll need to sort out first. And I don't think we're going to see him state a very clear, articulate foreign policy early on in his presidency. It'll be about setting things right at home first. So this doesn't mean it's going to be an insular Indonesia from here on in, but it means that he'll probably sort out some of these main problems domestically before we start looking about Indonesia in the region or the world.
Yep. I mean, and for Indonesia to kind of continue being the stable democracy it's been for the last 15 years, are there other things that Jokowi needs to address in the country first in order for it to continue being stable? I mean, where are the areas of investment you think he should focus on?
Yeah, well, I mean, in my particular research, I was looking at the role of media ownership. And so what has been a concern for Indonesia is that politicians and leaders of political parties have owned media companies, and then that has meant that the free press or the independent media has to be questioned. And this, of course, occurs in every country. Now, if you talk to different scholars, they would have different views. And I'm not saying this is the most important area. But for my research, I think that's something that Jokowi needs to address. And the general decline of court, the other options say the decline of religious freedom. So there's been more attacks on minority communities is another one. The issue of human rights, of course, and the 65 case. The numerous issues, of course. The challenges are many.
Sure, sure. I mean, but is Indonesia's democracy in a healthy state?
Well, that's a broad question.
It's a broad question. Yeah. But for the most part,
Indonesia is it's a free and fair elections. It was a fantastic occasion for many people who are watching Indonesia's democracy. There was issues with voting, particularly in areas of Papua. But overall, this was a wonderful case of the democratic institutions staying strong, holding tight, despite the threats of Prabowo saying that that the election wasn't fair. This is a fantastic result for democracy in Southeast Asia, and that should be remembered.
Excellent. All right, that's a good point to put across. And I know you said it's a little bit too early to tell. Obviously, as you and I both know, relations with Australia and other countries have been up and down, in particular with Indonesia, Indonesia's relations with Malaysia, for instance. But particularly in our case, we're interested about the bilateral relationship.
Yeah.
Without knowing much more about what Jokowi is going to do, what sort of things do you think Australia might do to put itself in the best position for good bilateral relationships in the future?
Yeah, sure. And again, I think what we've done in the past in Australia is we've very much tried to use a lot of rhetoric when it comes to Indonesia. And if you look back to 1975, in fact, Gough Whitlam, our Prime Minister, said he was best friends with Suharto. And then Paul Keating later on said he was best friends with Suharto. And then we talked about being great friends between leaders of Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono and various Australian Prime Ministers. So we focused very much on this, I think Kevin Rudd called a strategic partners. There's been a lot of rhetoric. And I think what Jokowi, I presume, looking at his track record, that he's not going to buy into a lot of this rhetoric. And in fact, he's a very practical person, and he's not going to want to be the international statesman and all these platitudes that we might give from Australia. He's going to dismiss. And I think this is a good thing. I think we can actually get down and say, these are the four or five topics that we need to work to in the relationship. And it's not going to be about grand posturing, which has been in the past. And so I think that's a positive thing for the relationship.
Look, I agree. That sounds good too. I'm just going to be a little bit provocative for a second. Obviously, towards the end of last year, if our listeners recall, there were some revelations, courtesy of Edward Snowden, that the Australian government had been attempted to tap into the phones of the president and his inner circle. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the reaction to that was less than favourable. The president suspended military and security cooperation in a number of areas, and that relationship has only started to be rebuilt over the last 8 months. Now, you talk about Jokowi being a bit more of a pragmatist and not giving in to rhetoric and perhaps, pomp and circumstance.
Yep.
How do you think he will react to those similar kinds of WikiLeaks revelations in future? Or what could Australia do in order to mitigate damage to the relationship?
Well, I mean, I can't answer how he would react to things, of course. It would be pure speculation. But I do think that one of the problems that our current government has had is they haven't explained situations well enough, including Tony Abbott in his speeches in Parliament, and we've tended to lecture Indonesia on how they should respond. And I think that if we continue with this approach in Australia, this won't be a good thing for bilateral relations, and it won't be a good thing for a number of other partnerships that were suspended, of course, during that period. Now, I don't think Jokowi is a type of guy who's going to withdraw the ambassador in the same way that Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono did. Twice, in fact, in his presidency, he did this. Jokowi would be a bit more practical, but certainly I think our approach needs to be to look more of a partnership and an equal partnership with a very important nation right on our doorstep.
I think that's right. There's a bit of advice there almost for other countries, though. I mean, if you are a Western country, Britain, for instance, has looked at reinvigorating ties with Indonesia in recent years. The United States, as part of its rebalance, is looking to ties. I mean, what advice would you give them in terms of building up ties, across various levels of the bilateral relationship, in particular with regards to Indonesia?
Well, I think, my line in all of this is that the more relations there are at different levels, not just bilateral relations. So people-to-people relations is something in Australia we've been talking about since the mid-90s. We've been saying that that's the substance to the relationship. We've been talking about language. We've been talking about more Australians learning Indonesian so we understand how the country works. And that would be my advice to any country, that if you're really going to operate on an equal level, you need to speak the language and you need to have greater connections into that country. So it's about doing more than just friendly relations between the leaders.
Excellent. All right. Thanks very much to Dr. Ross Tapsell for his insights today about the Indonesia election and what the key is to building better relations in future with a country like Indonesia. And thanks very much for joining us. Thanks to our guests and our listeners for joining us today about this discussion on Indonesia, a country of growing strategic significance. So don't forget to join us next week with more episodes of Sea Control. And you can download this episode and previous ones on the SimSec website at simsec.org. Thanks again.